Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And this show is going to be about suffering. Not just any old suffering. We're talking about your suffering. And maybe mine too. Yet, this is not about learning how to avoid suffering. We have a better way. And to help us find that better way, we have a guest on the show who has written a book called The Misleading Mind: How We Create Our Own Problems and How Buddhist Psychology Can Help Us Solve Them. And we're talking with the author, Karuna Katen. Karuna, welcome.
Good morning.
I'm so glad you could make it this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm very excited about your book. I not only read it, but I loved reading it. And it was so clear and helpful. And I've studied Buddhism since I was in college, almost 50 years ago. And I've lived with it. I've been a Buddhist in other lifetimes.
Right.
And it's very, very present in who I am. And yet, there's always more to learn and more to understand and digest about how our minds work and deceive us.
Right.
And you have a long practice of being a psychologist and a Buddhist.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, I don't know how far back to go, but I think as the mentions of the book, I went to, I was interested in the Asian studies back. I was also a product of the 60s and early 70s, and after going through the usual, scene with experimenting with drugs and the whole scene, I got very interested in meditation. And in those days, we only had yoga around, not much Buddhism. And so as a result of that, I was in college, and there was a year abroad program in Nepal. And I looked on the map and I saw Nepal was pretty close to India, and I'd always had that dream of going to India and finding a guru or whatever. So I thought, okay, I'll go on this Nepal trip and I can sneak across the border. But it ended up, that was 1975, and I stayed in Nepal, where I met my own teachers, two Tibetan lamas, Lama Tupten Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And they were presenting, it was the only place in those days you could, as a Westerner speaking English, could go study Buddhist thought. So I went there and I stayed for 12 years, and I taught English and set up some Western studies programs for the young monks and studied on my own as well. And when I came back in 1988, 12, 13 years later, I thought, what the heck do you do with all that experience? And Buddhism being, as the Dalai Lama says, mind science, the obvious thing was to become a therapist. So I got my degree in clinical psychology, and that's been that was back in the early 90s, and that's how I got into all this. But it was difficult because I had studied such a extensive, most people don't know, and that's, I think, part of the purpose of the book, is that Buddhist thought has a complete system of psychology, as you know, but it's somewhat hidden, only because, I guess, because of the translation and the language. And I really wanted to get this message out that there's a set of ideas that are secular and applicable to anybody. It doesn't matter what your religion or thought is, background, but this is a science of mind. And that's was the blend with Western psychology. But honestly speaking, the Buddhist psychology is, I found, much richer and deeper than what we've uncovered so far in the Western approach. So that's kind of my background.
Good, thank you.
In a nutshell.
Thank you. It's so helpful to understand this in the context of your history and your profession. Just this morning, it was interesting. I was counseling an Orthodox Jew,
uh-huh.
And knowing that I'm going to be interviewing you and having just digested your book, and it was so helpful in that counseling session to help her understand, how our minds get caught up in different concepts.
Yes.
And certainly religions have very strong concepts.
Yes.
And how we can really free our minds to love ourselves better and to love others better.
Right.
And
well, that's
go ahead.
Quite refreshing that it was helpful. I mean, that you describing that interaction actually makes me feel that, okay, I accomplished what I was looking for with the book, honestly, because I just want it to be helpful and applicable to people like you're describing.
Yes, and it's so applicable, and I'm living more, so much more with it every moment, because every moment we have ways that our minds can trap us into misconceptions.
Yeah.
And that's why the book is called The Misleading Mind.
Right. Well, that's that. Why the title, right?
Right, but you go into so many ways in the book to clarify the ways that we mislead ourselves in terms of our own self-identity, for instance.
Right.
Or the identity of others.
Right.
And we get trapped in that.
Yes.
And it's very hard to... because we've built patterns that keep reinforcing that.
Right.
And so we have to dismantle those patterns, really.
Yep, right.
And it takes constant work. And you say in the book, it's not an you're not going to be an overnight success.
No, and I worried, not worried about that, but that, I wanted to make that point clear because, I mean, you know, how do you think that fits with us, Western, modern, quick society where we are used to having solutions, you know, in a pill form or a quick form, you know, that was some concern to me that people would be able to accept that. But my belief is that as you try something, you know, that doesn't work long enough, you start reflecting more on, okay, well, what is really going to work? So it takes some reflection to look at what we do that isn't working. You know, that's the suffering part, right?
And you can feel it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a sense of, have I chosen a more objective point of view or not? And and if you haven't, you're still caught in the suffering of some concept of yourself or others or a condition or a conversation that can lead you down into a place that only creates more harm.
Yes. Well said.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, it's so important to me to hold this information. I hope our listening audience will be so curious now and excited about reading your book, because it's a way to understand ourselves with much more compassion.
Yes.
And
I agree.
And to love ourselves, even though we might have all kinds of ways that we know how to beat ourselves up.
Yeah.
I mean, no one is perfect. I'm not ever going to be perfect, but I can keep forgiving myself.
But it's hard, you know. A lot of modern psychology today has sort of a discomfort with looking at, you know, what is our, you know, even talking about that we have these disorders within us, you know, because when we look at the negativity in our minds, it's hard not to overly identify with them and personalize them, and then as it says in the book, we become depression, right? We become anxiety, and so I think that there's a strong movement, for example, which I support, but in the positive psychology realm, where it's only really focusing on, you know, the positive, we could say, I'm simplifying it, but, and that's partly because when we look at problems, our modality is that it's hard to separate from them and not take on sort of a personal guilt around the negative qualities of our own mind.
Well, I think that our survival mechanisms play a big role in trapping us because the habit of doing these behaviors and thought processes have allowed us to survive as far as we know.
Right.
We don't know that we can survive by dismantling that.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
We have to learn to trust that it's okay. But you're clear in the book that we're not trying to be a bunch of just do-gooders and nice sayers.
No. I mean, hopefully we end up there.
Yeah, right. But it's not about whitewashing everything.
No, that's the issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's about confronting, you know, confronting everything, really, and questioning. I love what I love in Buddhist psychology and philosophy is that, you know, when I first stumbled upon these ideas, you know, 1975, and there I was in this really crude hall, you know, a tent, basically a tent, listening to this Lama teaching in very broken English. And I remember it standing out that where he's saying, you know, quoting the Buddha as saying, you know, don't accept these teachings just because I teach them, but to examine them like you would examine gold. And I guess in the old days, you know, you use mercury and acid and you would test gold, yes. and you had the right to examine the quality of the gold that you were buying, and if it wasn't any good, you walked out.
Right, prove it out for yourself.
Exactly. And I'd never heard that before, because that wasn't faith-based. And I thought, wow, you mean I can question this? And since that day, you know, amongst the people that I associate with, you know, questioning and debate is integral to these ideas. And, you know, I just thought, wow, how liberating is that, that I can preserve my intellect at the same time develop a sense of, well, if you want to say spirituality at the same time. It's not a contradiction. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, and it's not following a religion. It's actually
not
honoring life.
It's right. I hope that we can get that message out, and that was an intention of the book. It'll take probably years for people to hear that, but they're hearing it. I mean, I'm not the first person, but it hasn't been long, has it, that we're beginning to get the idea that Buddhism is something beyond religion almost.
Well, some people. I mean, it's hard to separate. And right now, there's a lot of people are talking about spirituality versus religions.
Yeah.
And this is a teaching. This is a particular teaching within a religion, but it's a teaching about life. And and so many of the ancient, so much ancient knowledge is so much more sophisticated than we understand life today.
Right.
I've done some shows on the Bhagavad Gita, and it's so magnificent.
Yes.
And and so we have so much to learn from other cultures and ancient knowledge. And this is, it's not like psychology was just discovered with Freud and Jung.
Right.
These are such essences of living with oneself in happiness. And you differentiate in the book between pleasure and happiness.
Yes.
So let's talk about that, because pleasure is bringing us down a path that has a lot of thorns in it.
Yes, and that's our, again, this modern culture, material culture, is based upon more pleasure, if you can get to last a little longer. And I do want to, you know, I do try to point out, not successfully, but that, you know, pleasure is not the problem. It's the belief that pleasure and happiness are the same. It's very hard to have pleasure where we don't cling to it, right? We don't get stuck on it. We want more of it. We want to maintain it. And that's a trap, and that's a trick, and usually leads to more frustration. It's quite interesting when we are around, you know, cultures and people who maybe are not so bent on pleasure as a vehicle to happiness. They seem almost more contented. You know, overly seeking pleasure and clinging to it and attached to it. Attachment just means, you know, believing that it. I think of attachment in this case is pleasure is something that's moving, like a river, or like a stream, right? But when we seek it and when we have it, what we do is we try to freeze it.
Right.
And if we were to approach pleasure just as something that moves, it comes and goes, it's up and down, it goes from pleasure. The pleasure, when it subsides, it goes almost to dissatisfaction or boredom. If we could just ride that and expect that, then it's okay. Then there's no attachment. But when we try to hang on, hold it, freeze it, like a winter waterfall, you know, that's kind of how it looks like to me. That's where the problems arise. And then, of course, the disappointment when it eventually does fade. Right. Is sort of equal to the degree that we're trying to hold on to it.
So we're not saying not to seek treasures in life. For instance, a loving family is a treasure.
Correct.
And so we want to encourage people to keep on seeking treasure.
Yes.
But not be caught in it.
That's the idea is just to know how it works, the dynamics.
Right.
Again, and so the psychology of it. And so, you know, I think that, you know, I'm not going to see, for example, the pleasure of getting high or getting whatever, you know. I don't seek that anymore because I can't seem to when I detach from it, it doesn't really offer that much pleasure. When I attach to it, then I get into habits and addictions and all kinds of things, which leads to more pain, right?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how it works. I mean, if I can do it without the attachment, then it's, so be it. But there's some things I can't do without sort of clinging to them. Or if I do them without clinging, they just don't they lose their luster. They're not that great. You know, the walk on a beach, you know, with another person having being in relationship is almost more pleasurable than getting high because it's so less sticky, right? Or it can be, I mean, for me. And the coming down from the experience is not as harsh as when I, you know, might get high or something like that.
But you can identify any particular pleasure and see ways to be stuck in it.
Yes. And then we see that, right?
Right, sure. Yeah. I mean, you got to get off the beach sometimes.
That's right. Yeah, what happens when it gets cold and the wind starts blowing? It's so funny, isn't it? All of a sudden, you know, the situation turns into something that's not so pleasurable.
Right, and then we go into suffering.
And you know, we brought up in the beginning of the show about suffering. This is a subtle difference. That's a level of suffering that we can, I think I talk in the book about, you know, sort of three levels of one is sort of the pain of just pain, right? Like walking on a beach where, you know, where it's just cold, you know, or you're barefoot and the sand is rough on your feet. That's just pain to me. But the one that becomes more subtle, the two that become more subtle is that experience is going to change no matter what. We stay there long enough, the sun sets, it gets cold, we get hungry, whatever, but the change itself is suffering as well. And then the third thing is that we don't even relate to that whole experience in the way that it really exists, and we see it improper. That's the most subtle one and the hardest one for all of us to understand. So all those are identified as levels of suffering or lack of contentment, say.
Right. Well, I use a phrase that it's hard to hold sometimes. It's being okay anyway.
Yeah.
And I think that's the objective place that you can be in any circumstance when people are having problems at work or with other people in their lives and their families. And you can get caught up in the not okayness of it.
Right.
And also, you talk a lot in the book about self-image and how we're so caught up in our identities and who we're supposed to be and when we're supposed to be that. And it's so hard to let go of because we do have a sense of what brings us into esteem, and we don't want to lose that. And you know, it's hard. I'm getting on in age, and I'm doing fine now. But I'm looking at, you know, maybe in 10 years from now, I'll be at a point where I might not be as useful to people.
Right.
So who will I be when I'm not as useful to
people?
That's
right. That's right. Well, it's a good question but you know what's interesting about that is if we look just very, I don't know, calmly or objectively, there's Karunas in there and Peters in there that are quite functioning and quite healthy people that when 10 years from now you can become that guy. The more you cultivate that guy now, and that's not cultivating now, recognizing that, you know, when we walk on the beach by ourselves and if we're okay, you know, when we're okay and feeling good, that's one of those identities as well, right?
Right, but you might not be physically okay. What if you can't walk on a beach?
Have you been physically not okay and mentally and emotionally okay?
Well, yes, and that's the point you make in the book, too, about a woman in particular who was in a wheelchair.
Yes, my sister-in-law.
And it never got her down.
No. She's still the same way.
So we have wonderful role models out there. We need to find them, and it helps us to be okay anyway.
Right. But it's tough, but it's choice again, right? It's making the decision, as it says in the book, and those four steps I talk about. The first thing is to know that we have a choice.
Right.
That's so important, and most of us don't even know that. And so, like you were just bringing up about, you know, in 10 years from now, you probably know you have a choice now as to who you want to want to be at that time. But whether you cultivate that guy or not, that's in your hands, right?
Right, right. And yeah. We also have tendencies that we're born with, genetic
yes.
predispositions
yes.
to circumstances in life that are like ancestral genes and
yes.
et cetera.
Right.
And those are even perhaps harder to overcome.
They are. They're tough. They're just more, still more infused with our being. But they're not still, they're not who we are, but they're more, infused or have more of a history to them, don't they?
Well, but as you say in the book about suffering, is that the leaders in Buddhism talk about how they actually enjoy entering into the next suffering challenge.
Yeah.
So we can find ways that we say, oh, there's no hope for me now, you know. And
yeah.
and then actually, if you're true to this path, you'll say, oh, good.
Yeah. Well, you know, the reason they say, oh, good, is not because they're some sort of martyrs. It's because they understand that if, when they're suffering and pain, that the wrong idea of oneself pops up.
Yes.
So, you know, it's like if I have, yeah, that's what they're happy about, because they find that, oops, you know, I still got that guy around. Now I need to work with him.
Yeah, it becomes much clearer to them about
yeah.
where there's still need for growth.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And it becomes a new challenge and an opportunity, because also these are teachers, and the more that we can overcome our traps, the more we can help others.
Yes.
And that's true for even in families, just to help each other. You talk about, you know, disruptive families, and how do you deal with situations where people are just misbehaving and you're caught in it and you don't know a way out?
It's extremely tough. And, of course, it's not a simple answer, but we always have to go, what I feel is we always have to go to who we're at, what's showing up for us emotionally during those experiences. And, you know, some things, I mean, the more you just first start with where are you at in all this, how are you showing up? Are you getting violent and angry in it? Are you getting frustrated? Are you getting depressed? I mean, before you become effective, and this I tell my clients, I think that we all, once we begin to recognize this, find that it's true that we first have to be effective.
Right. We don't have to respond the same way.
We don't have to respond. The way to respond initially is, how am I doing? Because as we get more and sensitive, if I respond from anger or depression or fear, those responses usually are not going to produce the best results. Occasionally, short term, they can, but you're talking about being in a dysfunctional or dysfunctional family or something like that. That's going to go on for a while. Then you need to show up in the best way that you can, and we talk about that right in the book. You need to become confident that instead of showing up as depressed, angry, fearful. It is better to show up as some sort of basis of wisdom and empathy and warmth and skillfulness, too. You have to be powerful.
But not everything can be solved.
Not everything can be solved.
And then what?
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, because that's where the true test of this is to be able to accept our understandings of right and wrong.
It's very tough. It's very tough, and there is right and wrong on a relative, not everything is okay.
Right, but we can hold it in different ways. We have an attachment to it that we can let go and allow it to be there.
Yes, and it's painful.
Yes.
It's painful. I mean, even when you let go of the attachment to how it should be, it almost gets rawer, and sometimes that raw reality, you realize this is really a painful situation, and
yeah.
I think that's useful. But it is daunting at the same time, uncomfortable.
Yeah, so it's a rocky road to peace.
Yeah, it's a rocky road to peace, and the reason we do it is because we're into the long term. You know, we shift from the short term to the long term. So we see a lot of examples in politics that might be good analogies for us, but that's the tough part, isn't it?
Yeah, and also maybe to understand that it needs to happen.
Yes.
That sometimes we just things have to unfold for growth opportunities in ways that they need to.
Yeah, once we're committed, you know, I actually like the word spirituality because I think I define it a little differently than how most people think of it. For me, and I'm not the only one to do this, but for me, spirituality means being intent upon developing our inner qualities, which I feel are almost limitless. Okay. Right. So then every situation becomes a spiritual situation for us. That's probably the message of the book.
Yeah, and the underpinning of Buddhism as well.
It is.
Correction.
I agree.
Yeah, keep on finding correction.
Finding correction and then accessing these qualities that are just sort of dormant within us that are happier qualities for ourselves and others.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. Yeah.
I love it. And, you know, it's interesting how we live in these patterns and sometimes we really have to need help, like reading this book, to be able to step out of them and take some bigger breaths than we're used to.
Yes. Yeah. It's a whole shift, isn't it?
Yeah. It really is. And it's so important to have the opportunity to do that. And so I'm very grateful that you wrote this and have the experience you've had and the wisdom you have to make it so clear.
Thank you.
Because it's easy reading, I always look forward to the next page.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's a great endorsement. I appreciate that.
Oh yeah.
Because it's not easy. You know, that's the thing. I for me, I just feel like I'm an interpreter. You know, and I need to interpret these ideas for all the people that didn't have a chance to spend this much time in Nepal and with these teachers and doing the things I did. So they, you know, hopefully they can right. do it without all the sore knees and that I had and a crappy food.
Yeah. When I was young, I learned to speak Nepali.
Did you?
And I was supposed to go to Nepal, and then the plans all fell through, and I was even rated, Foreign Service rated in language, but I never had a chance to use it, and I've lost it all.
Oh, too bad.
But that was in the late '60s.
That's amazing. Were you in Foreign Service?
It was a Peace Corps program that.
Oh, because I was close friends with the first director of the Peace Corps in Nepal, Willie Unsold.
Well, you're going. I mean, it's too far back for me to remember anything. I never got to Nepal, and yet I've been very close to many, many Tibetan Buddhists in my life, and I knew that in Nepal I'd have an opportunity to really, you know, climb into it more.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, you've never been?
No, not in this life.
Well, maybe you can still go.
Well, it's all right. I'm not going to suffer about it.
No. You might suffer if you go.
Yeah, right. It's a tough country right now.
It's a tough country, yeah.
But it's good that you were there and got what you needed to out of it. That's great.
Yeah. Thank you.
And the book is The Misleading Mind. Your name is Karuna, Karuna Kayton, Cayton. How can people reach you?
My website, which is the Karuna Group, and also email me, karuna@thekarunagroup.com. And I'm happy to receive anything, emails. We're launching a new site, so it's just about up, but there's still a page available for people. They can order the book directly from the site or go to Amazon or any of the other book dealers.
Yeah, it's you have a good publisher and
yes.
a good publicist who brought us together, so I'm very grateful
for
Kim Corbin.
Right.
And thank you. This is so great to talk with you.
I appreciate it.
I feel very gifted to have this opportunity and to understand the misleading mind so much more.
I appreciate it so much, and thank you for having me on. And yeah, a wonderful discussion. I feel like we each have a cup of coffee between us here somewhere.
If you're in New York, please give me a call.
I will do that.
Email me too. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Karuna.
Take care.
You too. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. And I can be reached at Peter at HeartRiver, HEARTRiver.org. HeartRiver is my website, and I teach classes and do private consultations and all kinds of stuff. Very happy to talk with you or hear from you. Email. My phone number is 212-222-7748. And thank you so much for listening.